This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In the new book, Everything Conceivable, author Liza Mundy looks at assisted reproduction. Mundy says infertility rates and the boom in reproductive technologies are changing the way we think about parenthood, childbirth, life itself. Choice in family planning has come to include questions and issues beyond preventing pregnancies and terminating pregnancies. As Liza Mundy points out in Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World, never before in history has it been possible for a woman to be the genetic parent of living children to whom she has not given birth. Never before has it been possible for a woman to give birth to children who are genetically unrelated to her. This raises some tough questions, and so we are engaged as a nation in a debate about the nature and disposition of lab-made human embryos. We'll talk about these issues in this portion of the program. Liza Mundy is our guest. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Liza Mundy is an award-winning feature writer at the Washington Post magazine. Her honors include having her work selected for inclusion in the Best American Science Writing 2003. She was also a 2003 Kaiser Foundation Media Fellow and a 2005 Media Fellow at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Her book, Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World, is published by Knopf. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the discussion, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Liza Mundy, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on your show.
You open the book with a story of a husband and a wife, an egg donor, and an associate rector at an Episcopal church in California. The couple wanted the egg donor to be included and acknowledged in the baptism of the couple's triplet sons, if I can call them theirs.
Yes.
What were the questions Reverend Beth grappled with as she began thinking about the prayer she would write for the baptism?
Well, she had to try and figure out where an egg donor fit in the human family. I think, you know, it's safe to say she might be the first or one of the first ministers who had ever been asked to write a prayer recognizing and thanking an egg donor. And she had to, this is obviously a very ancient ceremony, and she had to figure out how to accommodate a new participant. These were triplet boys, so they already had a lot of godparents. They had a pair of godparents for each child, and she had the parents themselves. And so she had to really think about how to thank and salute an egg donor. She had to figure out what an egg donor stands for exactly, and also where an egg donor should stand. And she sat down and she tried to think how she would feel toward a person who had made it possible for her to be a mother. And she said that she found the prayer unexpectedly easy to write. And when she finished writing it, whenever it was that easy for her, she said she figured it must have been a God thing.
Later in the book, readers will meet a couple of men who have daughters, thanks to surrogacy, Doug and Eric.
Yes.
And I went back to thinking about Reverend Beth and how she would grapple with who would be in the church for an occasion celebrating the baptism of Doug and Eric's girls.
Well, isn't that an interesting question? Because in the case of Doug and Eric's girls, and these were twins, these men had availed themselves of both an egg donor and a surrogate. The egg donor provided the eggs to create the embryos, which were created using sperm from each man, actually. And so the twins had different genetic fathers. And then the embryos had been transferred into a surrogate, a woman in West Virginia, who was very happy to be helping a gay couple have children. And so, you know, you're right, that's a great question. It would have gotten even more crowded in the baptismal nave if Reverend Beth had been called upon to officiate at that baptism ceremony.
Yeah. Also, the story of Doug and Eric gets you thinking about what do we mean today when we use the word family?
That's right, and that's one of the reasons that these technologies are so interesting to me, because they are, I mean, you know, we already know that family can mean any number of things. We've been through a lot of different cultural revolutions, and we know that we can have single-parent families, or we can have families with divorced parents, and we can have step-parents and half-siblings, and we know that. But these are families in which have been sort of made that way on purpose. These are often families where there is a parent in the household who is genetically related to the child, and then if there is, say, an egg donor or a sperm donor involved, there's often another person who may or may not be known who is the other genetic parent of the child, and the child is probably not going to know that person. And so we're being forced to ask yet again within families, how much does the genetic relationship between parent and child matter? Does it matter if one parent is genetically related to the child and the other one isn't? Does it matter if the child has a genetic parent who is anonymous and unknown and may have contributed egg or sperm to create other families as well, so that the child may have half-siblings? And who gets to whose rights are paramount in this situation? If a parent prefers to conceive with the help of an unknown egg or sperm donor, is that abrogating a child's right to know the identity of their genetic parent? It's very confusing, and these are all questions that have by no means been answered.
Yeah. For this book, you talk with so many people, moms, dads, doctors, surrogate mothers, donors of eggs, donors of sperm, and children conceived through surrogacy and in vitro fertilization. What did you learn from the children?
Well, the children who... There's so many different forms of assisted reproduction now. There's IVF almost seems old-fashioned, and I would say the children of IVF are very, very happy to be here and to have been born. And, you know, I watched a press conference where a fertility organization advocate had her two sons come up, and one of them, they were among the first generation of IVF children, and they were talking about how thankful they were for the technology that made them, and one of them had been a frozen embryo for a while, and he said, you know, it's really surreal to be talking about the technologies that made me, but I'm just really happy for all the money and effort and science that went into, like, you know, making me. He sounded like any other teenager. But the group of children who have specific concerns, particularly as they're getting older, are children of egg and sperm donation, and in some cases surrogacy, who may, in fact, have a genetic parent who is unknown to them. And this is a movement. Some of these people are adults now, because sperm donation, in fact, has been going on for more than a century, and for many decades was a surreptitious, unacknowledged treatment for male infertility. And there are adults now who learned fairly, usually pretty late in life, because it was so secretive, that they're the product of sperm donation, and they have a pretty active movement to agitate for openness and to dispense with anonymity in what's known as collaborative reproduction or third-party reproduction. But in this country, it's going to be a hard row to hoe, because there is a thriving and very commercially successful industry in egg and sperm donation, and the vast majority of these donations are made anonymously. And so, you know, there are children being conceived every day with the help of egg or sperm, and they'll grow up probably not knowing the identity of this person. The baptism that I led my book with is really unusual. It's very unusual for a mother to A, to tell her children that she's conceived with the help of an egg donor, and B, to actually want to know the identity of that donor and want to know that donor and keep the donor part of the family. That is really unusual. Egg donation is a very rapidly growing subsector of IVF medicine. If women are in their late 30s and early 40s and having trouble conceiving, often IVF doctors will encourage them to use an egg donor. And more than half of these women will not tell their children that they are the product of egg donation, and the child will grow up thinking that this is not only their mother but their genetic mother. So it's a really live question in a lot of families.
How do women grapple with that issue, whether to tell or not to tell?
It's really hard. I mean, harder for some people than others. The woman who is in the opening anecdote in my book just knew from the start that she felt her children deserved to know the truth about how they were conceived. But there are certainly other parents who don't think that this is a big deal, who don't want their child to know that there is a lack of genetic relationship, who fear that maybe the child will be more bonded to the genetic parent or will want to track the egg donor down. I mean, these are the same fears that used to prevail in adoption scenarios, and there's been a lot of great research and a lot of good therapy and, you know, counseling available for adoptive parents to make them feel secure in their parenthood. But there's a lot of fear, I think, and uncertainty of people conceiving through third-party reproduction. And they worry, as one father said to me, if his sons were conceived actually with both egg donation and sperm donation, and he felt that if the sons wanted to track their sperm donor down, that would mean he had failed as a parent. He said, "I'm the dad, damn it." And he was being, you know, he was saying that with a sense of humor and love for his sons and ambivalence about the situation. But, you know, he did feel threatened by the donor who was out there. And again, I mean, these are things that I think adoptive parents work through and are helped working through. But with third-party reproduction, it's a commercial industry. There's very little counseling. Adoption is typically done by nonprofits who have often a long history with this and know how to help parents through it. But there's very little of that going on in the commercial reproduction industry.
Yeah, commercial industry. It's a big one. You report that in the greater Washington, D.C. area, there are at least 17 fertility clinics.
There are, between Washington and Baltimore, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I had no real insight into how many clinics there were. I was reporting a story for the Washington Post magazine on infertility as experienced by the poor. Infertility is more common the less money you have, often because of lack of access to good health care. And as I came to realize, you know, what a problem this is for everybody, I was also learning how many of my colleagues had been through fertility treatment as well, and that was my introduction really to the great need for infertility services. And as I began reporting this book, I came to realize, you know, how many clinics there are around here.
Yeah.
But not just urban areas. I mean, this is not just an urban issue or an issue that applies to working women. It's, you know, it's really something that's going on all over the country and something that affects men as often as it affects women.
Yeah. What is the situation for people without means, who are poor, who want to have children?
Well, that's really hard because the old cliche, you know, is that the rich get richer and the poor have children. There's this kind of cliched notion that the poor are all too fertile. And in fact, as I said, you know, infertility is often caused by infections that can, say, in a woman's case, block her fallopian tubes and scar them. I mean, that is the situation for which IVF was invented. The Petri dish was envisioned to be used as a substitute fallopian tube, and which is where conception actually happens. And the less money you have, the less likely you are to have gotten good health care for infections. And so infertility is more common among the poor. And when I was doing reporting on that, I encountered some really, really moving narratives in one case, I mean, not just the poor, but the working class as well, who lack insurance coverage for IVF often. And I interviewed a couple where the man was a air conditioning installer in suburban Maryland, and he and his wife very much wanted to have a child together, and they he sold his truck. It was a case of male infertility, and he sold his truck to afford a single round of IVF. And the couple were so happy when IVF succeeded. It looked like IVF had succeeded, and they went for their first ultrasound. And although they had had a positive pregnancy test, they found on the sonogram that what they had was a blighted ovum, which meant that fertilization had occurred, but there was no embryonic development. It was basically a miscarriage. And so he was in the situation of having, he was still making payments on the truck that he had sold, so he had no truck, no baby, and, you know, monthly payments of several hundred dollars, mm-hmm. and the doctor asked him if he wanted to try again, and he said, well, I don't have another truck to sell. But the doctor offered to give him a little discount, and the wife realized that she had just enough of a limit on her credit card to afford one more cycle. So they did it again. I mean, they were that motivated. People are that motivated. And in this case, IVF succeeded, and they have a beautiful little girl. But that just shows how hard people will work and the lengths they will go to afford these technologies. I interviewed another doctor who volunteered at the local free clinic for a lot of Spanish-speaking immigrants, and he said that he was afraid to let the staff tell them that in his working life he was a fertility doctor, because he said they would just be beating down his doors.
Hmm. What's the success rate for assisted reproduction technologies?
The success rate for IVF is about one-third. It varies a lot depending on the age of the woman. They say, you know, that in real estate, the key thing to think about is location, location, location. And unfortunately, in infertility medicine, the key question is age of the mother, age of the mother, age of the mother. But it generally, the success rates are about one-third. You have about a 33% chance of success. Unfortunately, they haven't really solved for women the aging problem. And if a woman is, say, 40 or above, the odds of success are going to decline significantly. And then this is when women are going to be encouraged to move on to egg donation.
Hmm. Are infertility rates rising? And if so, why?
Well, there's some debate about that, because although there's probably more age-related fertility than there used to be, because women are, you know, trying to conceive at later ages than ever before, there's probably less infection than there used to be, because we have, in general, better health care and sexually transmitted diseases. There's more awareness. And so, but then again, there's other causes of infertility, possibly having to do with rising obesity rates in some cases. So it's hard to track, and the government doesn't do a very good job keeping statistics on it. But certainly more and more and more people are availing themselves of infertility treatment.
And another thing that was interesting for me to learn is that scientists, apparently, you report this in the book, are realizing that infertility exists for a reason. What do we know about that?
Well, in some cases, you know, I think I mentioned that infertility is as common among men as it is among women. And in some cases, if the man is a carrier of a genetic disease such as cystic fibrosis, he may have a form of infertility that blocks the sperm from emerging. And one of the things that science can do now is enable almost any man to have a biological child. They can now retrieve sperm, even if it can't emerge, even if it's blocked. They can now go back in the sperm-making sort of assembly line and retrieve it in earlier stages. And they've developed a technique for injecting a single sperm into an egg that means that even if the sperm has low motility and would not itself be able to penetrate the egg, it can now. And one concern among scientists, well, they know that now men who have a form of genetic infertility that creates very low sperm counts, because of this injection technique, they can now father sons who will also be infertile. So an infertile man can now father an infertile son, which you know, would have been virtually impossible in any other era. And they have some concern that now that men who may carry a genetic disease, a gene for a genetic disease, will now be able to pass that along, and possibly in some cases the risk may be magnified in the sense that they don't know for sure, and there's work going on about that. Yeah, but in some cases infertility is kind of a firewall, I guess.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Liza Mundy, author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. Look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Is assisted reproduction regulated in this country at all?
It's certainly not as regulated as it is in other countries. And our medicine is not as regulated as it is in countries with socialized medicine. But for example, in the United Kingdom, where IVF was invented, there's a central government agency that licenses all fertility clinics, and keeps track of their success rates and also tells them what procedures they can and cannot perform, and if they want, if a clinic wants to engage in a relatively new scientific technique, they have to apply for permission to do so. And there are regular decisions made by government authorities about what can and can't be done. For example, there was a lot of controversy when they decided that it was okay for a couple to create what's called a savior sibling, which is to use genetic testing and IVF to conceive a child who will be a tissue match donor for an existing child who's afflicted with a genetic disease, and this is acceptable now in the UK, and it had been happening in this country, because in this country there is no central authority telling fertility clinics, well, you can do these procedures, but you can't do these procedures. There's nobody telling them what patients they can serve if a fertility clinic wants to serve gay couples or lesbians or single mothers, or doesn't, then they can make that decision. If they want to offer genetic testing or what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, they can make that decision themselves. The government in this country does keep track of outcome rates, of success rates, and the Centers for Disease Control publishes an annual report, but even that process is voluntary. If a clinic doesn't want to participate in the government monitoring program, it doesn't have to.
Mm. Do you think we'll see more regulation coming in the down the line?
You know, I don't know. This question comes up in virtually every interview, and it's much on the minds of people talking about it. But I have to say, there's even among infertility patients, there is a fear, and perhaps a well-founded fear in this country, that if the government gets involved in matters reproductive, then there will be some political slant. And so even among infertility patients, there's also a fear that somehow if the government gets more involved, that they themselves won't qualify, that a woman in her mid-40s might think that she would be considered too old, or couples fear that there'll be some kind of, criteria for qualification, and doctors obviously aren't asking to be more regulated than they are, and so it's not as though there's a groundswell. I think that one thing that could happen is advocacy groups are always agitating for more insurance coverage of IVF, and if there were more insurance coverage of IVF, I think insurance companies would exert a little more oversight, and in particular might try to reduce the number of IVF embryos that are transferred in a single cycle. And this, to me, was one of the most eye-opening and alarming discoveries I made in reporting this book. It's the consequences of multiple births. You know, we've had this enormous increase in the triplets rate, in the twins rate, and higher-order multiples as well. And I think the public often thinks, oh, multiples, twins, triplets, aren't they cute? Isn't that great? You know, an instant family overnight. But in fact, the health consequences are significant, and the stress often of raising multiples is greater than that of raising a singleton. Women's bodies are basically designed to carry one child at a time. And I think that whenever insurance coverage, whenever people have insurance coverage, they feel a little more as though they think, well, we'll be paid for a couple of cycles, we'll be paid. And so maybe we could just transfer one embryo or at the most two embryos this time because we know we'll get another shot at it because maybe insurance covers often up to three tries. Right now, in so many cases, people are paying for IVF themselves. They're paying out of pocket $10,000 or $12,000, and they want it to succeed. And so the pressure to transfer three or four embryos, you know, just to be sure, is enormous. And so I think, you know, in this country, insurance is often what regulates medicine, for better or worse. And I think if we saw more insurance coverage, we would see we'd see fewer multiples, and that would be a really good thing.
Yeah. Is anyone other than you worried about this, the multiple births, later pregnancies?
Well, certainly organizations like the March of Dimes and medical organizations have noted with alarm a rise in prematurity rates and in infant mortality and the sorts of things you wouldn't expect, you know, in a first world country with a fabulous medical system, and there are a number of reasons for this, but multiple births are certainly one. So there is concern about them, but I think probably not a consensus over what to do about it. I mean, IVF doctors don't transfer as many embryos as they used to, but again, this is an area of the medicine in which there is no regulation, and the choice is often left to the patient, and a doctor will say, well, we've got four good embryos, and you could transfer two or you could transfer three, so what do you want to do? Mm. And the patient makes the choice. And in some states where there's mandatory insurance coverage, like Connecticut, the insurance companies say no more than two. And so they essentially make the choice, and I think that's a good thing. So I think, you know, insurance companies recognize also that to pay the medical costs of triplets is something they would really rather avoid. So those insurance companies that do cover this, I think, realize that there's a real advantage in reducing the risk of a multiple birth. Mm.
Let's talk with a listener. A caller on a cell phone on line one. Hi.
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 I want to get back to how the children of some of these in vitro or surrogate mothers or something feel. We have four biological children and two girls that we adopted as teenagers. And occasionally when they get really angry with me or something, they'll say, well, you don't love me as much as the others because I didn't come from your stomach. Did you ever get that feeling from some of these children who did not come from their mother's stomach, in effect?
Well, that is the great fear of the parents, and that is the reason why often if a parent can get away with not telling the child, they will. And obviously, I mean, with egg donation, it is possible for a woman to launder the fact that she's not genetically related to her child. And some women say that, you know, when they're pregnant with a child through egg donation, they basically forget that they're not genetically related to the child. But even the process of being pregnant sort of solidifies their tie to the child, and I think it's so touching. I mean, clearly these parents love their children, just love their children as much as any parent does, and ironically, they're afraid that their child will not love them as much because of the lack of a genetic tie. But, you know, many of these children are still quite young, and good studies have not been done on how the children feel, and I think, you know, those adult offspring who are often, in this case, the product of sperm donation and are advocating for more openness, they aren't saying that they don't love their parents or they feel that their parents don't love them. They just want to know the identity of the donor for the most part. I think, you know, what research has been done show that the children of sperm donation or egg donation feel comfortable with their origins when they know about them. But in general, they have more curiosity about the donor than their parents think they will.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Other telephone calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Liza Mundy, author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. How are supporters and opponents now of Roe dealing with the questions posed by assisted reproductive technologies?
Well, it's an interesting question. When I was getting started reporting my book, I attended a conference that Planned Parenthood was having to discuss the new reproductive technologies and how to feel about them or how to think about them. Because for pro-choice advocates, for people who believe absolutely in reproductive choice, the question that is now at hand is whether choice should apply to these technologies. And for for some women's rights organizations, surrogacy has always presented a little bit of an ideological problem, because there's always the fear that a more affluent woman will be exploiting a woman with less money to have her child, or a more affluent couple. Not everybody worries about this, but some women's rights groups worry about issues of equity. And now that more and more gay men who are availing themselves as surrogates and egg donors, it's an open question for some reproductive rights advocates whether, you know, gay men deserve the same level of reproductive choice that they would argue women do. So as the choices get more and more numerous, it's harder and harder for women's rights groups to get their minds around some of these choices and how to think about them. Another one would be sex selection of embryos, which is possible. Through genetic testing, it's possible for a couple to identify which embryos are male and which are female and to transfer the ones that they want. And women's rights groups have traditionally been very uneasy with the idea of sex selection, because it often involves eliminating the females, you know, in countries where boys are valued more than girls. And so they generally don't like that, but are leery of any kind of regulation or limitation on even techniques that make them uneasy. Use of egg donors and surrogates and the possible exploitation of women, and also techniques that enable people to choose their child in ways that might make women's groups uncomfortable, these are all challenging for Planned Parenthood and for old line reproductive rights groups. I mean, I went to a 3-day conference, and there was certainly no consensus on any of these issues. There was just a lot of discussion and a lot of variety of opinion. That was very interesting to see, that this was a room where probably everybody in the room would agree on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. But when it came to initiating a pregnancy, mm-hmm. and the rights and the wrongs, there was no agreement at all, and that was just fascinating. For pro-life advocates and people of a pro-life ideology, it's hard as well. The whole stem cell debate going on Capitol Hill now is over really the moral status of the IVF embryo and whether the question of whether a pro-life philosophy would extend to a 3-day-old fertilized egg. And there's certainly a hard-line pro-life view that the president adheres to, that says, you know, we should not perform any kind of scientific research that involves the destruction of these embryos, even if it is life-affirming stem cell research. And the whole debate right now on Capitol Hill is whether federal funding should be granted for stem cell research on leftover IVF embryos. And this is very difficult because, there's some prominent pro-life politicians who bolted from this hard line and who now are willing to argue, a 3-day-old fertilized egg is really not the same thing as a fetus. And I interviewed one such representative, California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, and he and his wife went through IVF, and they have triplets as a result. And he was very gracious with his time and talked to me at length about how this really changed his view of the embryo, and he came to understand that human life can exist outside the womb, and he came to feel that IVF embryos will not grow into babies or human beings unless and until they're transferred into the womb, and he thinks that it's perfectly acceptable to perform stem cell research on IVF embryos that are still in the lab. So he considers himself still pro-life, but his position would differ very much from, say, that of the president. And so there are, you know, all sorts of new and fascinating realignments of position, I think, being and people who are being obliged to rethink old positions having to do with choice and life.
Yeah. You know, here's a tough question. If you hold to the view that the president has, what do we do with 500,000 frozen embryos in storage in the United States?
That's it. I mean, that is the great question, because we do have this vast accumulation of embryos. And another example of regulation in the United Kingdom, all excess IVF embryos are destroyed after 5 years. I mean, that decision is just made by the government. It's not made by the patients. And the first time this deadline was coming up, there was a bit of a pro-life protest, and apparently some women who were going to make themselves available to incubate the embryos, and there was a little bit of a, maybe there's a six-month delay, but ultimately they thawed and destroyed the embryos, and, you know, the world didn't come to an end. But in this country, nobody knows what can be done with these embryos, and doctors are afraid to destroy them. Even when patients move away or disappear or stop paying their storage fees, they don't really know what the status is of these embryos, their legal status, or whether someday there's going to be a wrongful death case if an embryo is wrongly thawed. And so it's really just very much up for grabs. But your question of if there can't be federal funding for IVF research on this, these embryos, what's going to happen to them is is unanswered. And there are, you know, there are some programs that exist, some of them pro-life and some of them just not ideologically driven, to encourage these embryos to be, quote-unquote, adopted by other families, by infertile couples to use somebody else's frozen embryos. And couples are very willing to do this. When somebody is willing to free them up. But, you get back to the question of choice. I first became interested in doing this book when I was having lunch with a reporter who was pregnant with IVF twins, and she talked about how hard it was to know what was the right thing to do with their frozen embryos. They had thought originally that they would donate them to another infertile couple, but now that she was pregnant, she could not imagine having her own children's full siblings being raised in another household. And that's, you know, it's all well and good to redefine the family, but it can be sort of hard to, the redefinition, it can be pretty drastic. And she really could not get her mind around the idea of full siblings being raised in another household and didn't know what she was going to do with the embryos. And I certainly haven't heard a proposal from opponents of funding for stem cell research, a proposal for what to do with these embryos.
Yeah.
It's a great question.
How long can you hold a frozen embryo in that state?
One of the things about the science is that embryos are pretty durable, and nobody knows for sure what the shelf life is. They don't get freezer burn, and in San Francisco a couple of years ago, a child was born from a 13-year-old frozen embryo, and that may or may not be a record anymore. It's probably pretty close, but nobody quite knows.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to where we began with, back to a church and a reverend. What is the involvement of religious institutions in these questions? And what guidance are people like Reverend Beth Pera offering their flocks?
Well, I think that's highly individual.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to answer in the case of the Catholic Church, which opposes IVF and fertility medicine in general as an unnatural means of conception. And so that is the Church's official position. But other religious denominations, I think, don't take a hard and fast line. There was a fascinating article in the New York Times a while back on rabbis who were being trained in these questions, because I'm not an expert on Jewish law, but I understand that in cases of surrogacy, where the surrogate herself is not Jewish, there would be some question when the child was born as to whether the child was Jewish, because it is apparently sort of passed on in utero. And I think there is a ceremony now for a child born of surrogacy to be considered Jewish. So on sort of on points of law and custom, these questions arise. But I think in general, you know, pastors have always counseled infertile couples. I mean, that's one of the things that Reverend Beth said, that she had among her flock couples of all ages who had come to her, you know, basically for grief counseling about infertility. And this is something I'm sure that minister and pastors have always heard from the people they counsel. But I interviewed another woman who was pregnant with triplets, and this is a very difficult decision for patients. There's something called selective reduction, where a patient carrying triplets or a high-order pregnancy might, quote-unquote, reduce the pregnancy down to twins or singletons. And I watched this procedure be performed, and it's a very difficult procedure to watch and very difficult for the patients to undergo. And when she was trying to make the decision of whether to reduce her triplets pregnancy, she did seek out pastoral counseling. So I think probably ministers and pastors are getting this on a case-by-case basis, because patients have all of these unexpected choices to make, having to do with how many embryos to transfer, whether to reduce a high-order multiple pregnancy. You know, is it better to carry a triplets pregnancy and put all the triplets at risk, or is it better to sacrifice one of the triplets and ensure a healthier life for the two that are left? I mean, that is a really hard question, and people certainly seek counseling about that. And then the question of what to do with frozen embryos. That's what is so interesting to me about this technology, is it just introduces all these new moral questions that really people are making at this point, you know, individually. Couples are hammering out these questions themselves and really sort of turning to their own you know, in internal moral codes. And I would think pastoral counseling would sometimes be part of that for couples.
Boy, what amazing choices. Some of them, on the one hand, you know, you can have a child. On the other hand, all along the way, you might be confronted with these really gut-wrenching decisions to make.
Well, that's exactly it. And in my book, I have lots and lots of people and lots of narratives. You know, the gay couple, when their surrogate became pregnant with twins, which was a very risky situation for her. Obviously, in their case, before that, how many embryos to transfer was a decision they had to make together with their surrogate. And so I was just fascinated by the new decisions that are being you know, that people are obliged to make, and combinations of people are obliged to make together.
Yeah. Is it known how many babies in the U.S. are born each year with thanks to ART?
Well, the estimate is about 50,000 through IVF. In my book, I include fertility drugs as well, and nobody really, I think, is tracking how many children are born from that, and also children of sperm donation. And the estimate there is it very fuzzy numbers. Anywhere, the old number they used to say was 30,000 children every year conceived through sperm donation. It could be higher than that. So, you know, at least 100,000 children every year from all these techniques. But I suspect probably quite a bit higher than that.
Yeah, and then when you move out into, you know, all the people that are involved.
Yes, that's right.
It's just it's a mid-sized city.
Yes. Donors and surrogates and yes.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Liza, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much. It's always fascinating for me to talk about all this, and I appreciate your interest.
Liza Mundy has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. The book is published by Knopf.